He's a madman!
Led Pan Limares crushed the parchment in his powerful hand. The courier from Delaval City shrank back from the wild man, eyeing the door of the tavern's common room as if searching for an escape route. He wasn't the only one. Of the 30 men and women in the room, all seemed more than a bit unsettled by the powerful man's outburst. All save one, dressed in monk's robes and sitting calmly at the same table Pan Limares had occupied when he had been handed the note before he had leaped up fuming.
A madman!
He is the king of Hants.
When the laird of Palmeris Town fixed Father de Gilb with a severe glare, he merely shrugged.
Read it!
He demands that you attack Chapel Abel.
Yes! He wants me to throw all that I have against those walls, with the monks hurling fire and lightning at us from on high.
And with your finest warriors off rampaging in the Far East.
It is madness.
Foolishness, at least. King Yezelnik is a man who does not yet understand battle.
Am I to write his lesson in the blood of Palmaris Town's garrison?
Are you?
No. We cannot go against such a fortress as Chapel Abel. Not with their magical powers and with my ships getting sunk by Powrys behind them. Powrys! Of all the ill times to have Powrys in the Gulf.
A remarkable coincidence, you believe?
Is it not?
Among those who did battle against ancient Baden were a pair of Powrys.
Laird Pan Limares and many others looked at the monk incredulously.
It is true. When the highwayman dropped ancient Baden's head at Dame Guidra's feet, he was accompanied by the man Cormac, who betrayed me, by a barbarian woman, and by a pair of bloody-capped dwarves. He introduced those Powrys to Dame Guidra as friends, and the Powrys wintered in Castle Pelennor.
This cannot be.
But it is, I tell you. They wintered in Castle Pelennor and were given free passage from the city as soon as the snows had calmed.
Powrys!
Ugliest little creatures I have ever seen.
You believe Dame Guidra enlisted the little beasts?
I know that Dame Guidra did not kill the two who came to Pelennor. I know that she released them and that the one called the Highwayman named them as friends. Friends help friends, do they not?
Laird Pan Limares stared off into nothingness for a long while, his eyes narrow, his nostrils flared. His defeat at the wall of Chapel Abel had stung him profoundly, but the loss of three warships had positively infuriated him. He slammed his fist down on the table.
I will confront Dame Guidra in parley. If she is in league with these beasts, then one day soon Vanguard will bow to the rule of Laird Pan Limares. Soon.
Pedal faster, you mutts! Or we're to miss all the dippin'!
Up in the squat tower, the Powry watched as a pair of barrel boats closed fast on a warship, another flying the colors of Palmaris Town. Below and behind him, the tough dwarves picked up their pace. The barrel boat leaped away across the dark waters.
Yeah, but you call that fast? You mutt! Me dead mum could swim past you!
He was smiling wider as he finished, but his grin disappeared a moment later when the Palmaris Town warships attacked. Deck-mounted ballista, giant spear-throwers, let fly at the nearest barrel boat, launching thick, weighted netting. Their shots weren't true, but didn't have to be, for just putting the spears near to the boat, which was no more than 20 yards from the warship's broadside, sent the net over its tower, hooking fast and draping over the back half of the boat. The drag slowed the craft immediately, and worse, the netting hooked the barrel boat's single propeller. Instead of charging in now at high speed to ram the warship, the barrel boat was suddenly adrift and tilting as the heavy weights pulled at her. Spotters ran along the warship's deck, pointing out the second approaching barrel boat while the ballista crews reloaded. A host of archers appeared at the rail and began raking the trapped barrel boat, even as some of her crew tried to climb to cut the netting free.
He was ready for us.
Stop your peddling! Stop, I'm telling you!
McGuigan came to the base of the ladder.
Guidra's boat!
hold Morristown still, but they're coming out ready.
McQuiggick grimaced as he considered the scene. The trapped barrel boat was listing now, water splashing in through her tower. Dwarves tried to come up, and arrows cut them down. The second boat had turned, but the warship, too, was tacking to give chase.
They ain't seen us yet.
We got to be quick and hard.
McQuiggick smiled at him and punched a fist into his open palm. Schicknickel lifted his signaling mirror and turned it behind the boat, where he knew three other barrel boats to be on the prowl.
Lay quiet! They'll go by us chasing our friends! Almost!
They're turning inside us, are they?
Schicknickel smiled.
Swing out wider! Slowly! They're looking the other way! So keep our spray down and keep them looking the other way!
McQuiggick went back into the hold. Facing the crew, he held up his right hand while slowly turning circles with his left, and the right-hand crew began a slow pedal, executing a left turn.
Quarter!
The crew began to pedal in unison at easy pace. As the Palmaristown warship continued its turn and gained speed, obviously unaware of Schicknickel's boat or those trailing, the captain called for a turn back to the right.
Falling fast! And get ready for a jolt!
The powery barrel boat was built for head-on collision, with a devilish ram leading its charge just below the waterline. Many buffers had been engineered around that ram, and, even without them, the thin planking of a typical surface sailing ship would have proven no match for the concentrated pounding of a barrel boat's solid ram. Slammed against a stopped ship with only the power of peddling dwarves, that ram would still break through to some degree. In this case, with a barrel boat coming in at an angle before a fast-sailing ship, the explosion knocked every dwarf from his seat and sent McQuiggick flying against the front inside wall. The powerful ram drove a gaping hole in the starboard bow of the warship, and the momentum had lengthened that hole considerably, splintering planks near to midship. Without even being told, the Powerys rushed back to their seats and began pedaling in reverse. The barrel boat finally slid free.
Put her back a dozen and watch the show!
Get your caps ready, boys, for she'll list over soon enough.
Much rubbing of hands ensued. Within a very short time, the Palmaristown warship lay on her side, most of her underwater. Men bobbed and splashed or hung on desperately to the rigging while the Powery boat circled like sharks. Schicknickel led the way onto the deck.
Bring up the gaff hooks!
Heartbeats later, the first third of the crew in rotation had climbed from the tower, long hooked poles in hand. The remaining dwarves pedaled slowly, bringing the barrel boat beside one floundering sailor after another.
Oh, no, please, no, sir, please. I have a wife and a little girl.
And you should have stayed home with me.
Schicknickel slapped his gaff hook down hard, catching the man by the shoulder and hauled him to the side of the rounded deck. Other dwarves were fast to the spot, serrated knives in hand. They expertly opened up the best areas for a long and thick bloodletting. And so it went throughout the rest of the day until the sharks arrived. The next morning, the seas were calm. The Palmaristown ship and all her crew gone from sight, with not even flotsam to be seen. The Powery captains and their top advisors all sat atop their respective decks.
Where to then? I'm getting tired of waiting for them fools to come out here in the open waters.
Palmaristown, west and at the mouth of the river.
And with most of her fleet down. And most of her men out fighting on the field.
Half a dozen barrel boats started out to the west. A shiver of sharks. Hungry sharks. They were in range of Palmaristown's archers, but in range, too, of the monks of St. Mirabel's Wall, with their devastating gemstones. Dame Guidra and Laird Panlemaris rode from their respective ranks simultaneously, meeting on the field at a tent Panlemaris's men had set up. Beside Guidra rode Father Primujan and Brother Pinaur, and a pair accompanied Panlemaris as well, including Father de Gilb. The sight of the large and imposing monk distressed Guidra, but not as much as it unsettled poor Primujan. She felt naked out here without Dawson beside her. Reports magically collected by the brothers had reached her of his escape from the Palmaristown ships in the Gulf. She was beside herself with relief, but sorely missed the man she had leaned upon for so many years. Given the events in the Gulf, where Palmaris Town warships had somehow been defeated, Gwydra eagerly accepted the invitation to parley with her opponents, hoping against reason that the impasse might be at an end. As she neared the tent and noted the expression on Laird Panlimaris's face, her doubts overwhelmed her optimism. A table had been set inside the tent, three chairs on each side. Gwydra took hers in the middle, directly opposite Panlimaris.
Lady, it is good to see that some among you have a bit of honor at least. A very tiny bit.
Good tidings to you too, Laird Panlimaris, who came unbidden with his army to the gates of a chapel and stained the field before her with the blood of innocent men.
Innocent?
Panlimaris silenced Father de Gilb with an upraised hand.
You know Father de Gilb, and this is Captain Dunlevin Brosh, who commands the Palmaris Town fleet.
Father Primujan of Chapel Pelennor. And this is Brother Pinauer, who speaks for Saint Mirabel.
What? Saint?
Saint Mirabel. Until recently known as Chapelabel.
The fool art a leavin. Does he think that his symbolic gestures will help him against the inevitable fall? Will he hide behind a name? A name he dishonors with every treasonous action he takes? We will return to our mission when I am installed as the proper head of the Order of Abel.
You support this subversion?
Subversion? You would say that to me after what happened in the Gulf?
Your ships tried to attack—
You sent Powrys against my warships. Powrys! Bloody capped dwarves working in concert with the ships of Vanguard.
You are mad to think that I would—
It's a coincidence, then? That the ships of Vanguard were allowed to sail free while the ships of Palmaris Town were sent to the bottom, all hands slaughtered? Am I to believe that a cruel trick of fate, Dame Gwydra? Or am I to call it what it is? You and your church have allied with the Powrys against the men of Hants.
That is a lie!
Father Primujan leaped from his chair, as did Brother Pinauer.
Enough! You requested a parley, for no better reason than to offer this slander?
Is it slander, Dame of Vanguard?
I know nothing of any Powrys in the Gulf. I know only that your warships gave chase to my ships unlawfully and without provocation.
Without provocation? You have come here and stolen Hant's land.
I have offered support to the autonomous Abelican Church, which chooses secession before giving in to the heinous demands of the one who calls himself king, to murder men taken honestly in honorable battle. Shame on him, and shame on you if you agree with such a thing. Laird Panlimaris was known throughout Vanguard as a man of honor, but I wonder if that is still true, if you would agree with this vile edict of King Yeselnik.
Panlimaris sat for many heartbeats in silence, never blinking as he looked across the table at his adversary.
Reconsider your course. Come back into the fold of a unified Hants. And you as well. Your father Otto Levin's time is past, but we can salvage the remnants of your order. All can be forgiven. Even Father Otto Levin's reputation can be protected when he quietly retires, but only if you act quickly and wisely.
And if we do not, you will storm the walls of Saint Mirabel once more?
Or perhaps I will cede Chapelabel to you and lock you in your walled prison. The waters of the Gulf will be mine in short order, despite your evil alliance with the dwarves.
There is no such alliance!
Whatever the case may be, I will own the Gulf. The Palmaris Town fleet will find allies from Delaval City soon enough, and we will chase the vile dwarves from our waters. I will hold you in this prison of your making, your own little kingdom, while the armies of King Yeselnik debark in Port Vanguard and sweep your holding out from under you. How inviting will Chapelabel's walls seem then, good lady?
Suddenly it was a staring contest between the two, across the table, and it became apparent quickly that Laird Panlimaris wasn't nearly as confident as he sounded. Still, Dame Gwydra didn't blink. The six rode away soon, in opposite directions.
So now we know how Dawson escaped. Powries. Powries? I cannot declare them God sent, though I surely am glad that they chose their targets well.
It is a minor victory, as was our victory when we turned back Laird Panlimaris's charge. Neither offer far-reaching consequences or relief if the outcome across Haunts continues in favor of King Yeselnik and his brutal lairds.
And Father de Gilb. He will fight us to the death, and more than a few brothers, I fear, will follow his angry call.
It is going to be a long, dark summer.
Send out couriers to my son. Runners across the land and a battle group of your fastest warships to run the coast in the hopes that he is near enough to see their penance. Together, Milwellis and I will drive the traitorous witch from her castle and right into the sea. And then we will win the waters of the Gulf as I promised, and will bring Vanguard under the rule of Palmaris Town.
Palmaris Town?
King Yeselnik will be so grateful to us for putting the Order of Blessed Abel back into his fold under the fine Father de Gilb. So grateful that we crushed the insurgent Gwydra that he will allow me to expand my holding to the north all the way to the borders of Valpinador.
Yes, my lad.
And even if he does not, simply killing Gwydra and Artolivan will be worth the war.
He felt naked before her. She was slight of build, with dark hair and brown skin and dark, darting eyes full of energy and life that scrutinized and drank in every inch of Branson.
You carry the sword of Jester too?
I do.
You dress in clothes of mystic warrior?
Yes.
You are Jester too?
My mother, Sin Wee, was Jester too.
Mother?
Sin Wee of the Walk of Clouds.
I do not know this name.
She left many years ago, 21 years ago. She married my father and came to Haunts with him.
You do not look of bear, not fool.
My father was of Haunts, a monk of a Haunts church, who went to Bear and the Walk of Clouds, where he learned from your masters.
And they taught you?
I never knew my father. My mother died the day I was born.
But you know!
From the Book of Jest. My father penned a copy of the Book of Jest.
You taught yourself?
From the corner of his eye, Branson saw Afwin Wee thrust her hand to silence the bald-headed warrior. She stormed around to stand before Branson.
I did. From the book.
Afwin Wee stared at him for a moment.
Mawal Yana says you are worthy of the sword.
Branson gave a slight bow, which he knew to be the proper acceptance of such a compliment.
Why are you here?
I came to find the warrior who broke a sword in the chest of King Delavore. I came to find the jester too, to honor my mother and to learn.
You were friends with this Delavore?
Hardly. His successor wants me dead.
Afwin Wee waited a few moments, even glancing back at Mirwal Yana, who offered a slight nod in reply.
You came to learn?
To confirm that I am correct in how I follow the Book of Jest. And to learn, yes. To learn more about this philosophy that has so guided my life. I have seen the broken end of your sword, and I knew it to be Jester too. So, I came to find you.
You are worthy. You may join with me.
Branson felt as if his heart would pound right through the front of his chest as he considered the implications, the great step forward he had just taken.
Your friend will leave now.
The shock of that jolted Branson from his whirling thoughts. Despite the orders placed upon him, he glanced back to the far edge of the clearing, where Jamieston stood between the pair who had captured him.
Be gone.
Jamieston eyed Branson.
I care not where, but far from us. Now, be gone.
I'm supposed to watch over the boy.
He is not a boy. He is a man. He follows Jester too. How are you, who are not Jester too, to watch over him?
I was...
You are not. Only one more time, I tell you. Be gone.
Jamieson looked in question at Branson again. The young warrior nodded. Jameson met Branson's eyes for a long moment before returning that nod in farewell and slipping off into the forest, leaving Branson nervous and very alone and very naked indeed under the withering gaze of Afwin Wee.
He uses your stones, priest. And he fights as just a two. You will protect your leader, and my people will protect him.
Efwin Wee spoke when Father Destros of Chapel Entel balked at arming his monks with sunstones in Laird Ethelbert's hall for the meeting with the strange highwayman.
Are you not confident of your abilities to protect, my lad?
The woman's hand snapped up quicker than Destros could react, her poking finger right before his eye, meaning that she could have jabbed that finger right through his eye had she chosen to do so. Father Destros had to remind himself to breathe. She was right, of course. This wasn't about their growing personal rivalry, but about the safety of Laird Ethelbert. He went to his desk and retrieved a sunstone, pocketing several others as well. When he entered Laird Ethelbert's audience chamber a short while later, he had the sunstone firmly in his grasp. Not only would the gem allow him to counter any use of magic, it would allow for detection of magic as well. Destros figured that he might learn more than a bit about this mysterious highwayman. He only wished that Afwin Wee hadn't been the one to deliver the suggestion, and certainly not the command. Jameson Sequin picked up his pace. He knew that he had already been seen and was being followed, so moving stealthily really didn't help him much. Perhaps they were just ensuring that he continued far from Ethelbert's holding. Jameson had passed this way the previous night, knew the lay of the area, so he moved quickly to a cluster of abandoned, mostly ruined cottages. Jameson picked a fairly concealed course and stealthily gained the door and slipped inside. He went fast to the far corner and put his back against the solid wooden wall, watching the door. He hadn't long to wait. Within moments, a black-clothed figure entered the dimly illuminated one-room cottage. Jameson smiled, thinking it the same woman he had battled earlier that day.
You should relax and tell me why you're following me.
Caught by surprise, the woman froze in place, slowly swiveling her head to regard the man in his leveled and ready bow. She stood straight and turned to face Jameson squarely.
Don't even think about trying to get back out that door. You're leaving in front of me, in case your friends are about and curious. Now, tell me why you're following me.
The woman narrowed her eyes.
You won't get to me, and you won't get out that door. And you won't get a dagger or some other bolt in the air before I let fly. I don't miss. So start explaining why you followed me.
You ought to be gone.
I was going. Do better.
The woman lifted her chin defiantly. Jameson pulled back on his bowstring just a bit more.
I'm going to ask you just one more time.
Branson was not wearing his mask across his eyes as he paced into Laird Ethelbert's audience hall beside Afwin Wee. They strode right up to the large chair on which sat the aging Laird, a disarming smile on his face.
So, this is the highwayman. Yes, young warrior, I have heard of you even here. I was quite sorry to learn of the death of Laird Pryday.
He was killed of his own actions by his own champion.
Yes, yes, I know the sad tale.
Do you know he was trying to rape my wife when Bonnegrand's axe found his chest?
Proper respect.
That is quite all right, my huntress. Better that this one speak the truth in his heart, so I may better come to know the truth of him, yes?
Afwin Wee gave a curt bow.
And I do know enough of Pryday to acknowledge what you claim. Well, let us just say that he was not capable of such an act.
That did not stop him from trying, or from falsely condemning her mother to the Samhastes.
I surrender. I will not replay those events, and will not argue with one who was there when I was not. I was saddened by the death of Pryday, a man I had known as an ally in battle. Whether he deserved it or not...
Branson accepted that reasoning with a bow.
And you are an interesting mutt, are you not? You wear on your forehead the gemstones of an Abelican monk, yet you fight with the techniques and clothing of the southern mystics.
My father was of the Order of Blessed Abel. My mother, a jester too.
I know that. I met your father and your mother on their return from Bear. They came through my city 2 decades ago, and I granted them an audience. It did not end well for them, I assume.
Branson's face went from a sudden brightening to a dark cloud at the grim reminder of Bran and Senhui's respective fates.
I warned your father that the brothers would not be as tolerant as he hoped.
Branson felt as if the ground was shifting under his feet. He had come in here full of confidence and determination, and now Laird Ethelbert had maneuvered the conversation to a place that clearly had Branson on edge. He wanted to hear more of Ethelbert's encounter with his parents, and he knew that such desire ensured that he would not. Ethelbert read him perfectly and quickly deflected the conversation yet again.
You know of my struggle with Laird Yezelnik?
I thought he called himself King Yezelnik.
He can call himself God Yezelnik if it pleases him, because when I kill him, it will not matter at all.
Branson didn't react.
So I have met him as you desired. What is the purpose? Is he friend or is he foe?
He states that he is Jester too. He would pledge loyalty to Laird Ethelbert.
Branson looked at her in surprise.
Because I am his superior, and the decision is not his to make. Is that not true?
Yes.
Is there anything more?
Speak your mind freely. This is your last chance to do so.
I am Jester too, in part. But because of my heritage and my experience, I am more. I have found the promise with my father, the joining.
Efwin Wee hit him so hard across the face that he was sitting on the floor before he had even registered the pain of the blow.
You are Jester too, or you are not. Which are you?
I am Jester too.
My arm's getting tired and I just might let go.
You must be gone!
I was going.
Jamieson bit it off, suddenly realizing what she really meant.
So that's what it is it? You can't have me wandering on my way knowing what I know. Well, I know a lot more now, I expect.
Jamieson instinctively glanced down and then he knew, for the nunchuck had blown right through the wall behind him and into his back with such force that Jamieson's leather jerkin was pushed out in the front.
Oh, no.
Jamieson muttered, realizing that the pole had gone right through him. Already the feeling was leaving his legs. He looked up at the woman who stood easily now, smiling at him. Jamieson managed a nod. She got her arm up with amazing speed, but the arrow bored right through her forearm and into her forehead. Jamieson was sitting when the fierce warrior came around the front and entered through the door. The scout wanted to put his bow up for one last shot, for one last chance to kill this vicious man. But when he lifted his left arm, he only then realized that he wasn't even holding the bow anymore, that it was on the floor at his feet. Murwal Yana crouched over the dead woman, then rose and glanced at Jamieson. He would come over and finish the job, Jamieson figured. But surprisingly, the man just turned away. Jamieson watched as the warrior cradled his fallen friend, then carried her out of the house. And as he left, the darkness began to close in on Jamieson Sequin. McQuiggick leaned his elbows on the top of the small barrel boat tower, staring at the distant fires and candles twinkling in the windows. So many lights. More than McQuiggick had ever seen. More than he had ever imagined possible. For 100 years he had looked across the waters of Mithranadun, where even a single firelight was an oddity. For many years of life before that, the largest collection of people together he had ever seen was the town of Hard Rocks on the Weathered Isles. But even that place, once thought impressive, couldn't have been 1/20th the size of this.
Gotta be Palmaris Town. We're at the mouth of the river, and that's where Schick Nichols said it'd be. We get 10 of us boys together and we call it a town. 30, and we call it a city. 100, and it's a kingdom. Lot of people in there. Yeah, lot of blood. We get killed to death in there, and there's none to be burying our hearts. Pah, we won't be knowing that anyway.
The Powery Shiver stayed offshore as the lights went down in the city, and only then did the eager dwarves resume their peddling, moving very slowly and quietly. With 130 warriors among all the boats, they figured they'd find themselves outnumbered 100 to 1 or more. dreams of berets shining brightly enough to light up the night carried them on their way. Branson sat on the roof in the inn in Ethelbert Dosentel, his legs tightly crossed before him, his hands on his bent knees and his eyes skyward, basking in the contemplative light of a million stars. His thoughts were out there and within himself all at once, a meditative state of serenity in the face of the great questions of purpose and being. The stunning revelations and twists of the last day stayed with him, nagging him with doubts, particularly on where Kaydale might fit into his new allegiance to Afwin Wee. She had dismissed Jameson out of hand. What might that portend for Kaydale? Branson threw away that unsettling thought. He forced himself back inside his Kichi Kree, his line of life energy, and then sent that line spiritually up into the dark and starry sky. A different sensation tugged at him, though, and suddenly and unexpectedly, a feeling that something, somehow, was amiss. Branson interrupted his meditative journey to refocus on this disturbance, this ill feeling. It had direction, like a cry of pain out in the dark night. Branson let his soul slide through the soul stone of the brooch and escape his corporeal form. He started away spiritually, but hesitantly, until he felt again that strange sensation that something was terribly wrong. Then he moved with purpose, willing his non-corporeal form over the city's wall and out across the empty fields to the edge of a forest he had traversed that very morning. The docks were quiet, those few guards on duty either asleep or gambling, throwing bones against a warehouse wall. One or another would occasionally glance at the harbor to check the masts of the few ships in port. Barrel boats didn't have masts. The Powery craft came in slowly, their underwater rams prodding the sand below the wharves so that even as the dwarves climbed from their craft and slowly walked across the top arc of those rams, they remained out of sight to the distracted guards up on the boardwalk.
Beat that point!
The bones rolled a strong number. The words had barely left his mouth when a mallet cracked down atop his head.
As you asked!
How the other four guards started to scramble, started, but never even made their feet. The dwarves methodically formed into six units, each crew as a battle group. They used the very bones the men had been rolling to determine which of the six would stay behind and watch the boats for the first forays.
Oh, not to worry. It's plenty to kill.
Five battle groups moved up into sleeping, unwitting Palmaris Town. 100 weapons, 100 serrated knives to open veins. Like a plague of hungry rats, they roved through the town, sweeping through houses and tenements. They came in and they killed. They dipped their bloody caps and they moved on. It took nearly an hour, with hundreds and hundreds murdered, before Palmaris Town even began to organize any semblance of defense against the intruders. Many, many more people died to Powery blades before the dwarves faced any real resistance. The bloodbath went on throughout the night, a night that would be known in the region for decades hence as the Dark of Long Murder. And when the Poweries finally did retreat, they set fire to every structure they passed, so that by the time their barrel boats pushed back out into the river, a quarter of the great city was ablaze. By the time those fires finally died away days later, two of every three structures in the great city, the second largest in Hans, lay in ruins. One in every three residents within the city was dead. Warships sailed fast for home as the word of the tragedy spread, but the Poweries, with their shining berets, slipped past them unnoticed into the open waters of the Gulf. Using the cat's eye gemstone set in his brooch, Branson had no trouble navigating the darkness beyond the wall of Ethelbert Dosentel. He ran on light feet, falling into the malachite as well as the soulstone to provide added lift and distance to each desperate step. He nearly fell over with fear as he skidded to a stop before the small cluster of ruined houses. Behind him, in the east, the sky was still dark, still hours before the dawn. Branson tried to hear again the psychic cry, but all was silent. He summoned his courage and ran into the house to find Jameson crumpled on the floor, blood pooled about him.
No!
Branson reached into the Soul Stone, bringing forth mighty waves of healing magic. But Jameson was already cold. Branson dug deeper, seeking any flicker of life energy, any notion that the man's soul had not yet fled, seeking resurrection itself, something even the greatest of gemstone users had always believed impossible, something Abel himself had never managed, because it was not possible. Jameson, this man he had come to know as a friend, as a teacher and mentor, as a father even, was lost to him.
A storm?
Brother Pinnour stood on the wall with Brother Giavno looking out to the west. The sun was not yet halfway down from its zenith to the horizon, but a dull pall had already settled on the land, a premature twilight. Brother Giavno was shaking his head before Pinnour even asked the obvious question.
No, not a storm, not clouds.
Pinnour looked at him curiously, and the man's grim expression, horrified even, had the young monk even more perplexed.
Smoke.
Smoke? But that is too far. I see no flames. It is out to the horizon and more.
Brother Giavno didn't bother to respond. It was smoke, he knew. Somewhere far to the west, something big was burning. More monks came to the wall over the next few hours as the daylight waned and the gigantic cloud in the west grew darker and more ominous. Across the field, the army of Palmaris Town seemed equally engaged by the spectacle. Many brothers stayed on the wall after night fell to view the sky three quarters full of stars and one quarter the western edge, an eerie combination of blackness built on the foundation of an ominous orange glow. Dawn's light showed the cloud expanding still, and that morning everyone in St. Mirabel moved to the towers and the walls to view the spectacle. Even Dame Guaidra and Father Arto Levan.
What could it be?
Oh, Palmaris Town.
The highwayman is still out there.
King Yezelnik spoke to his perfumed wife.
And do you think he is coming to slay you?
Don't be flippant with me, wife.
He didn't kill your uncle Delaval.
You know nothing. We found his sword.
There are many swords.
Not like his.
Perhaps he dropped it or someone took it from him.
Plundered his corpse, perhaps. That would not please you, would it?
I do not know of what you were speaking.
King Yezelnik slapped her hard across the face. It was the first time he had ever done anything remotely like that. When she lifted her hands to try to deflect him, he punched her squarely in the nose.
I will hear no more of the highwayman from you, ever!
Oh, you spoke of him first!
Ever! Bonagran will kill him. Kill him! Panlamoris will deal with those traitors at Chapel Abel. Why is this so hard? Why don't these fools just concede to the inevitable?
You are king.
Yezelnik spun around to see his wife sitting up. He looked at her curiously, then more closely.
You are the king of Haunts. Only the prideful laird of that miserable city in the south and the traitorous fools at Chapel Abel refuse to see it. All the rest is yours.
Yezelnik continued to stare at her, but he felt compelled to move over to her. He fell to his knees very close and stared into her eyes, one swelling from his punch.
Gather the lairds who follow you, the dozens who love you. Lend them warriors to extend their holdings to engulf all of those flattened by you and your glorious march and by Prince Midwellis. Take the Inner Coast and the Mantis Arm. Take all those communities along the Belt and Buckle. Take them all and let Ethelbert and his city and the monks in their chapel watch from their walls as the world, as King Yezelnik's Haunts, goes along without them.
Yezelnik's jaw hung open, for never had he heard such advice from this source.
They cannot come out against you, or you will destroy them!
Delaval warships will blockade Ethelbert Docental.
Yes!
And Chapel Abel, a prison of their own making.
Yes! Oh, yes!
And I will send Pan Lamoris by land and by sea into Vanguard, and Dame Guidra will know her folly!
Lead them yourself! You are the King of Haunts!
Yasonic tackled her, showering her with kisses all over her face.
Take me, my king! Ravish me!
Yasonic nearly swooned, overwhelmed, for he had never seen his wife in such a state of passion aimed at him before. His confidence grew with every kiss and every caress. It was good to be the king.
Pan Lamoris.
A lone rider stormed across the field toward St. Mirabel.
That is Laird Pan Lamoris himself!
The large and imposing laird of Palmaris Town drew closer to the wall. That cloud of smoke rising in the west, that sign of Palmaris Town burning, served as a white flag of temporary truce in the stunned sensibilities of all who glimpsed it. Although Palmaris Town had come against St. Mirabel, even in the face of the executions of Fatus and the other brothers, the image of certain horror occurring in the west allowed Pan Lamoris to make his ride unhindered right to the base of St. Mirabel's high wall.
To eternal flames with you, damned witch! The blood of thousands of mothers and children stains your pretty hands. How will you wash it away?
Dame Guidra rocked back on her heels.
She is here, as are those in support of her. Whatever ill has befallen your city...
Powries! Powries by the score! Powries set loose by the Witch of Vanguard! What horror have you set upon the folk of Haunts, wicked Guidra?
I did no such thing!
As in the harbor with my ships! And now a cowardly assault on a sleeping city to cut the throats of children and burn the buildings to ash. Eternal fires for you, I say. And oh, but do not doubt that your precious Vanguard will feel the wrath of Palmaris Town, of Pan Lamoris and Mil Welles, of King Yezelnik, and all the goodly folk of Haunts. They will know you, powery friend, and they will loathe you. I await the day when Dame Guidra is dragged through the streets of Palmaris Town that all may spit upon she who invited the Powries back to Haunts!
He whirled his mount around and thundered away, and not an arrow or bolt of gemstone lightning reached out after him. The siege of St. Mirabel ended within the hour, Laird Pan Lamoris and his army moving with all haste back to the west. Later that same day, Prince Mil Welles' army appeared in the distant south, moving with great speed to the west, to home, to the ruins and the dead. How had this happened? How was it possible that this man, so competent, so formidable, so seasoned, had been taken down? What manner of foe had come against Jamestown to corner him and defeat such a warrior? Jamestown had successfully battled trolls and powries and barbarians, even giants, for decades. Who could possibly have brought him down? There was only one answer. Jester too. Branson knelt over Jamestown for a long while, cradling the man's head, trying to come to terms with his loss. The minutes continued to slide past, and still Branson sat, recalling his first meeting with Jamestown in the wilds of southern Alpinador, when the scout had joined in a fight against a company of ancient Bodden's trolls. He remembered the look on the face of Crazy Vanna when she realized that it was Jamestown Sequin. Then Jamestown Sequin joined in their cause. Walking with Jamestown these last weeks, Branson had come to appreciate that awe-struck expression of Vanna's all the more. For truly this man more than matched his impressive reputation. Now Jamestown was gone. How alone Branson felt at that terrible, terrible moment. Not just alone, but confused, consumed by the unsettling notion that he had played a role in this, that he had allowed Afwen Wee to dismiss Jamestown and send him away. All those thoughts swirled and coalesced, first reducing Branson into a battered and defeated shell, weak in the knees and unable to hold back his tears. The stretch of pity and self-pity and hopelessness lasted only a few heartbeats, replaced by a bubbling rage that turned Branson's churning gut into a pit of pure acid. He gently laid Jameson's head back and jumped up to his feet, seeking focus, seeking an outlet. He considered the hole in the wooden wall, punched through with tremendous force. He turned Jameson's body over a bit and noted that the same blunt force had hit him with enough power to skewer him. An image of Murwal Yana and his exotic weapon flashed in Branson's mind. Jameson had been near the wall, his back to it when slain. Branson turned to see what his friend might have witnessed at that moment and noted blood on the floor by the door. He went to it, following the clear trail of blood droplets to the back of the cottage, a short distance into the forest, where he found the remains of a makeshift pyre and the charred and shrunken remains of a person. He saw a black silk slipper and knew beyond any doubt. No simple soldier had taken down Jameson Sequin.
Jester too.
Branson felt his jaw go tight, the muscles in his arms and legs twitching in anticipation. It took him a long time to slow and steady his breathing, to find his center and his mind-body connection. He couldn't hold that connection for long. Too overwhelmed was he, too betrayed and confused, and too angry. Branson turned to the east, toward Ethelbert Dosantel, toward Afwen Wee. Sprinting nearly the entire way, Branson reached the wall of Ethelbert Dosantel before dawn. The sky over the Myrianic glowed in pre-dawn light, but stars remained clear in the west. The city was only beginning to awaken. The highwayman used that slumber to his advantage. He moved along the wall, listening carefully, until he came to an out-of-the-way corner where he could climb and keep the still-dark western sky at his back. The highwayman went over silently, the dark sky behind him presenting no silhouette for the half-aware sentry to observe. Branson crossed over quickly, allowing himself to drop to the ground in near silence because of heightened balance. Though he could see Castle Ethelbert, it took him a few moments to get his bearings and determine the best way to navigate the crowded city. Time he didn't have to spare as more sounds of the city awakening filled his ears and the sky brightened a bit more. He started at a trot, quickly a run, letting that low but imposing castle guide him. Afwen Wee and her group were in a wing of the castle. In short order, he could see the balcony from which his spirit had answered Jameson's dying call. He could just go back in the room. It was unlikely the others knew he had left or had learned their terrible secret. Prudence called him to that plan, but anger prevented it.
No.
This was no time for secrecy and plotting, for deception and caution. Or perhaps it was just such a time. Branson, so consumed, didn't care.
No!
He walked in the front door of the castle's far western wing, the complex afforded Afwen Wee's group.
When did you go out?
Paxet Va greeted him immediately.
How did you get out?
Va shook his head, his top knot dancing with the movement as he looked across the way to his companion Mo Li. Mo Li responded, stepping through a hanging curtain to look curiously from Paxet Va to Branson.
You did not tell me that this one left?
He did not. Not while I guarded.
I left from my balcony.
You cannot do this?
The highwayman smiled slyly and walked right up to his poking finger.
You live only on the command of—
Shut up!
Paxet Va's eyes popped wide.
Shut up!
Paxet Va slapped him hard across the face.
Shut up now!
The man moved to slap him again, but this time the highwayman used Paxet Va's incredulity to get inside the man's defenses.
You will pay the price!
Without even a glance at him, the highwayman strode up to tower over Paxet Va, still not looking at Lee. The highwayman drove his foot down hard on Paxet Va's throat. At the last possible moment, the highwayman reached down and grabbed the sword on his left hip with a backhand grip so that he easily pulled it free and snapped it back out under his right arm, the blade stabbing behind him just as Mo Li leaped for him. Mo Li had come in with a flying kick and had taken the sword into the back of his thigh, a deep, deep wound.
Shut up!
The highwayman stalked through the room and kicked open the opposite door into the small anteroom before Afwin Wee's large chamber entryway. That second door swung wide before Branson crossed to it. There stood Murwal Yana, staring at him, staring at his bloody sword. No look of revulsion showed on Murwal Yana's face, though. Indeed, the man's smile widened wickedly. The highwayman reacted with anger, leaping ahead. But Murwal Yana anticipated the charge, for he was moving even as Branson did. The warrior from Bear leaped backward and to the side, and the highwayman went through the door in a rush, skidding to an abrupt stop, acutely aware that Murwal Yana was not alone in the room.
You act rashly, warrior.
Afwin Wee was standing in a corner of the room.
Just the two do not act in such a manner.
But they murder without cause.
He found his friend.
The warrior snapped out his nunchuck in a dizzying, spinning blur. Branson didn't know the exact translation of the phrase, but he recognized it as a plea from the warrior that Afwin Wee allow him to fight this battle alone. From the corner of his eye, he watched Afwin Wee relax and stand up straight, bringing her hands together before her chest and offering a slight bow before stepping back. Branson's gaze shifted back to Murwal Yana. The Baronese's face was locked in a stare of absolute concentration and simmering eagerness. The man went into another flourish. The highwayman didn't let him continue his display. Branson rushed forward with a sudden and ferocious stab, retraction, and slash of his blade. Up came the nunchuck, spinning and snapping. Branson stepped quickly back against a sudden burst of snapping nunchuck's thrusts, the pole popping forward in the air before him in rapid succession. He felt a chair behind his heels and jumped backward reflexively, landing lightly. Over the chair came Murwal Yana, leaping high in a spin. He landed with his right side facing Branson and unrolling his right arm out at the highwayman, the nunchuck lashing out like an extension of his arm. Instead of backing away, the highwayman went forward and leaped high above the swing of the nunchuck. He threw his sword up past Murwal Yana, a daring distraction. Branson turned as he sailed and kicked out, scoring a stunning blow to Murwal Yana's face. He landed close to the warrior, his chest against Murwal Yana's outstretched hand. Without slowing, Branson punched his right arm under Murwal Yana's elbow, then stabbing it out across the man's back, planting his hand firmly against Murwal Yana's opposite shoulder blade. At the same time, with his left hand, he grabbed Murwal Yana's weapon hand. As soon as he had executed this locking hold, Branson drove forward and upward hard, throwing all his weight into the move. Branson leaped over him in a crouch, left hand extended against Murwal Yana's face, lining up a surely fatal blow from his cocked right arm. And a blow did fall, a hard one. But it fell against Branson before he could finish Murwal Yana. Afwin Wee's kicks staggered him to the side.
You murdered Jameson!
He attacked those sent to make certain he had left.
No, never! Not unless he were forced to defend himself!
Foolish young man.
I came here as a fellow traveler in the way of Jester Two.
I am not Jester Two. Who lay?
You lay. The title rolled around Branson's head for a few moments until he connected it to his reading of the Book of Jest. Hugh Lay, the tradition that had inspired Jester Two, an old mercenary warrior class, a tradition of divorcing fighting skill from moral judgment, of preparing for battle under the will of whatever sheik or king paid most handsomely. A Hugh Lay warrior was an instrument, a weapon, and nothing more.
You are paid assassins.
Afwin Wee shrugged, as if that fact should have been apparent long before. Back and forth, they circled and slapped, hands stabbing like striking snakes, hands striking hands. They went faster, more furiously. Unused to this style of fighting, Branson could not keep up. He was hit by more blows than he landed. Every strike the expert Afwin Wee delivered was in perfect balance, her weight behind the blow, her angle precise. Branson reached into his brooch and met her flying form with a lightning discharge that sent her flying back the way she came. The highwayman focused on the image of Jameson, focused on his brooch, focused on the power of Abelican gemstones. He became a living torch, using the malachite in his fury to hurl himself at the Hugh Lay warrior. She tried to dodge, and Branson knew he had her. He crashed into her, bringing both to the floor. Branson closed his eyes, not wanting to watch the flames curl her flesh. She laughed at him, punched him in the face, and wriggled away. Branson looked down to see that his flames were no more. He looked up at Afwen Wee to see her smiling smugly, her hand extended, a gemstone in her open palm, a sunstone, the stone of anti-magic.
I know your secret, Highwayman.
Branson tried to yell his fury, but his words came out garbled, indecipherable, stork-like.
Damn it!
He would be stronger. He reached more deeply into the brooch and this time felt the connection through the static of the sunstone. Branson leaped to his feet and charged. Another furious exchange brought him around to the side. Still, he couldn't keep up with the speed of Afwen Wee, so he focused his blocks and counters to his right side. Predictably, the Hulei warrior seized the opening and launched a left hook Branson could not block. He didn't try to. Taking the hit and using the force of the blow along with his own sudden retreat to open the ground between them enough to scramble to the side and grab his sword where he dropped it. But the incredibly fast Afwen Wee was there to stomp on the blade. Branson had to let go of the hilt and throw his arm up to block. The highwayman fell back and tried to turn his head to make the hit a glancing one, and indeed, he was nearly out of Afwen Wee's reach. But she wasn't trying to strike him. Her slender fingers caught the edge of Branson's magical brooch and wrenched it with her as she fell away, tearing the skin, tearing away the magic. He was the stork again. So suddenly, so helplessly, blood running freely from his torn forehead. He somehow got one leg under himself and stumbled halfway to standing, but Afwen Wee was there, dropping a series of heavy and strategic blows, more to taunt and hurt him than to finish him. All the world was spinning. Branson hit the floor face down and helpless. Afwen Wee could finish him with a stomp to the back of his neck. He tried to turn and nearly got to his side when her foot slammed him in the gut, doubling him up. With a sudden burst of energy, Branson pushed up to his hands and knees and scrabbled away. He thought of Jameson, dead Jameson, and of Kaydale, whom he would never see again. He thought of all the promises of his road and his life, of his brooch and his consistent strength, of the hopes and dreams he had dared entertain, of his unborn child.
No!
Afwen Wee walked up to him, the highwayman, with all the grace of a Jested Two warrior, kicked his leg out behind him and hit her in the knee, locking her leg painfully. The highwayman leaped up, spun about, and launched a barrage of punches and kicks that had the Hulei warrior backing desperately. He charged as she backed. His barrage did not slow, and all momentum fell to him, to the highwayman, the Jester too, the angry warrior. Fury guided but did not consume him. He punched and kicked with rage, but with all his strength and speed in complete control. He focused on the sheer wall of denial that drove him but never lost sight of his surroundings or of his opponent. Thus, when Afwen Wee feigned a block and fell to the floor, rolling in to take him out at the legs, the highwayman reacted by leaping straight up into the air so high and gracefully that it felt as if he remained connected to the malachite. He landed in perfect balance, so lightly and perfectly, now towering over Afwen Wee, who had to work doubly hard and at an awkward angle to try to fend him off. The highwayman stayed focused enough to detect movement to the side and to get his arm up just in time to block the sliver of silver flying at him through the air. Mo Lee lifted another missile. The spinning, many-toothed disc flashed past the crouching highwayman. He had to finish Mo Lee quickly, he realized. He glanced at Afwen Wee, thinking that he might have to fend her off fast and then make the run to her companion. She stood with his sword in hand. Another disc flashed out at him. He couldn't dodge and had to block again, this time the disc slicing hard as it deflected off his hand, all but severing his little finger. His digit fell limply to the side, hanging by nothing more than a strand of bloody skin. Branson made a decision. He swung his hand around gingerly as he brought it in close, catching the swinging finger in his grasp and tucking his fist tight against his ribs. He broke into a run. With a great leap to the side, he crashed through the grated window. He dropped to the courtyard on his feet and kept on running, never looking back. Blinded by pain and confusion and a profound sense of despair, the highwayman ran through the Entel morning. He smashed his way through the market, upsetting carts and rushing down an alley. He found the strength to lessen his weight and make a great leap to a low roof, then scrambled from there to the city wall. To his surprise, he found no pursuit, but he kept running because to stop was to face the awfulness that had found his life. And he feared, too, that as soon as he settled and took a full measure, his moment of clarity, of escape from the stork, would be at its end, and he would become helpless once more. Exhaustion finally caught up to Branson on a rocky hill several leagues north of Ethelbert Dos Entel. He stared at the crashing waves of the Mirianic for a short while, his mind racing. His anger was gone, stolen by remorse, shaken by disappointment as profound as anything he had ever known. All that he wanted at that terrible time was to get back to Kaedale, to sleep in her arms, to forget the wider world. He had lost everything. But he knew that he would never forget Jamestown Sequin. He was surprised by the magnitude of that loss. This man he had known only a few months, whom he had come to know only in the last short weeks, had become so important to him. A friend, a mentor, almost a father. And in his excitement and thinking that he had found Jester too, he had sent Jamestown away. It had been there all along, Branson realized, as he slumped to the dark sand beside a ridge of black rock. He hadn't needed any tutelage from the Jester too. Was there anything they could teach him greater than the wisdom that Jamestown had shown him along the road, truly? Because, most of all, Jamestown Sequin had reminded Branson to look within himself, honestly and openly. Jamestown had nudged him to consider the truth of the many roads before him and to come to terms with the responsibilities of his training and skill and that gemstone brooch. The brooch. Branson's hand went up to the dried blood on his forehead, the torn skin where the brooch had been set. He tucked his legs back under him and stood up suddenly, then sprang to the ridge of lava stone, a leap of several vertical feet. He had no soul stone. No fury drove him. What was this transformation? Had the gemstone's magic so closely attuned to his line of life energy cured him of his malady? Was the stork lost to him forever and without need of a magical crutch? Or was it a temporary fix? The thought haunted Branson suddenly. He looked away from the dark waters of the Mirianic to the north and west toward Chapel of Bell, where he believed Kaedale to be. He had to get there, to her, and to Father Artolivan. He had to be near to a cache of soul stones in case this confusing clarity could not hold. More than that, even without the stones, even if he became the stork again forever and evermore, particularly if he became the stork evermore, Branson needed Kaedale's warm embrace. He didn't know if the clarity would last. He didn't know that King Yezelnik was even then summoning the Lairds of Haunts to begin a new and more determined offensive to wipe the world of Ethelbert and Artolivan and Gwydra. He didn't know that Palmaris Town had burned and that the rage of much of Haunts was even then refocusing against Dame Gwydra. All that he knew was that he needed Kaedale, needed her beyond desperation. He started away and didn't look back. So he didn't see the sails of Lady Dreamer gliding above the dark water behind him, nearing Ethelbert Dos Entel and the meeting of desperate men that would become the last, best hope for the Land of Haunts.
The Saga of the First King, Book 3, The Dame, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2009 by R.A. Salvatore. Published by arrangement with St. Martin's Press Macmillan. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2012 by The Cutting Corporation, Incorporated. All rights reserved. with performances by Christopher Sheeran, Terrence Aselford, Bradley Smith, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Mort Shelby, Patrick Bussink, Stephen Carpenter, Colleen Delaney, David Coyne, Daniel Sontag, Nick DePinto, Thomas Keegan, MJ Casey, James Keegan, Johan Detweiler, Yasmin Twazon, Alyssa Wilmoth, Kimberly Gilbert, Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Ken Jackson, Scott McCormick, Drew Copus, Christopher Graybill, Ren Casey, Joe Brack, James Lewis, Karen Novak, Evan Casey, Richard Rowan, and Gary Tells. Adapted and directed by Johan Detweiler. Produced by Richard Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johan Detweiler. Featuring original music composed and performed by Dan Smith and Johan Detweiler. If you enjoyed the Saga of the First King, be sure to look for R.A. Salvatore's Demon Wars Saga, John Sprunk's Shadow Saga, and Brent Week's The Lightbringer Trilogy. All available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio.
Don't think I give a damn that you're my father.
The thought never crossed my mind.
I don't know you, and I don't want to know you. All you ever gave me was a rep to live up to. I done it too. Maybe I haven't killed as many men as the famous Frank Morgan, but my day's coming, old man. My day's coming.
Can Frank Morgan gun down his own flesh and blood? Find out in The Last Gunfighter number 23, Montana Gundown. Available now in graphic audio. Smoke Jensen's wife is shot. He will carve a bloody path through all of Colorado, leading straight to the heart of the villain. If you think you know violence, you ain't seen nothing yet. Don't miss The Visceral Revenge in The Mountain Man number 39. Assault of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.